from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on this morning's pre-recorded edition of Forum, we discuss the general strike of 75 years ago that changed the face of labor here in the Bay Area and throughout the United States and had enormous impact on San Francisco city politics and its culture and much more that continues to endure to the present day. On this Labor Day, a look back and an assessment of the ongoing legacy of the San Francisco general strike. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Labor Day Forum. And on this Labor Day, we bring you a pre-recorded hour all about the San Francisco general strike, which began on May 9th, 1934, when 10,000 longshoremen went on strike up and down the West Coast in protest of daily hiring practices and low wages. July 5th, two men were killed and many more injured, which led to a solemn and large parade of thousands on San Francisco's Market Street and the official declaration of the general strike from the 18th of July, excuse me, make that the 16th of July to the 19th. The famous strike had an enormous impact on the labor movement and on San Francisco city politics and culture, as well as continuing to have an ongoing legacy that endures to this day. And we'll talk all about it in this morning's pre-recorded Labor Day Hour of Forum. Let me tell you who is joining us for this hour. We want to welcome here in studio with us William Issel, who is Professor of History Emeritus at San Francisco State University and Visiting Professor of History at Mills College, Coordinator of Bay Area Labor History Workshop. Welcome, Bill Issel.
Thank you.
Also want to say good morning to Dick Meister, freelance writer and columnist who co-authored a history of farm labor called A Long Time Coming, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Morning.
And Harvey Schwartz, also with us here in studio for this pre-record, who is curator of the ILWU Oral History Collection. That's the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And Solitary Stories is his book. It's an oral history of the ILWU. Welcome, Harvey Schwartz.
Thank you.
Glad to have you all. And before we begin by, well, going back in time and also educating, we hope, a lot of you who don't know what the general strike was or what its effect and its legacy is, we want to hear some footage, newsreel footage, about the strike from the Prelinger Archive, which we thank them for, made available by shapingsf.org. The clip was part of a newscast that was broadcast back in 1934. Listen to the announcer's voice. We don't hear these likes these days, describing activity on the day called Bloody Thursday.
Efforts of business interest to forcibly open the strike-paralyzed port of San Francisco failed. Open warfare rages through the streets of the city as 3,000 Union pickets battle 700 police. Guns, tear gas, clubs, and fists bring injuries to more than 80 persons and cause the death of two. Listen to the strikers' side of the story.
We are asking for a general strike to keep organized labor on the Pacific Coast. We are not only asking for it, but we're going to get it.
Then with a general strike and additional violence threatened, 2,500 guardsmen move in.
Well, there was what was known as Bloody Thursday, but there was a lot leading up to this. Harvey Schwartz, let's talk about that. As I said, certainly there was a lot of unrest and a lot of concern about organizing and doing something about wages and about what they call the shape-up. Give us the picture. What was the shape-up, first of all?
Well, the shape-up was the hiring system on the waterfront in San Francisco, and workers by the hundreds would go and gather around a person who was doing the hiring. And essentially, you were there to beg for work. And in many cases, people paid kickbacks. That is to say, you would pay money or you would bring a bottle of wine or whatever to the person doing the hiring. It was in many ways a degrading and very, very difficult situation. Sometimes you'd go to the waterfront and you would not get a job and you wouldn't, you'd be out of luck that day, but you'd have to go back the next day. Also, you would...
Hold on just a little bit from the mic, if you would, just a tiny bit.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Even if you were in what was called a steady gang and you were in a gang that worked every day, you had to go and shape up that morning, every morning, nonetheless.
It was pretty gratuitous. There was a lot of bribery and corruption.
There was a lot of bribery. There was a lot of corruption. On the Los Angeles waterfront, I can remember working telling me if you had a good-looking sister or wife and you brought that person to the waterfront, you could get a job by servicing the hiring person. And I can remember his emphasis when he said, I've seen this happen on this waterfront in my time.
Well, what this led to, along with the low wages, was perhaps one of the most dramatic labor eruptions in American history. And Bill Issel, it is forever identified with the character and the person of Harry Bridges. Why?
The press then and opponents of the radical factions of the American labor movement seized upon Harry Bridges as a ideal target with which to discredit the labor movement generally. First of all, Harry Bridges was born in Australia, not the United States. Secondly, he had lived in the United States for, what, 10 years, Harvey? Roughly 10 years
roughly,
without
yeah.
becoming a citizen. So he was still a non-citizen. And thirdly, he was identified as being a communist or close to the Communist Party by the press and by those leaders of the laissez-faire faction of the West Coast employers who were determined to hold the line against what they saw as Franklin Roosevelt's betrayal of his own business class origins.
Now, when you mentioned Harry Bridges as a communist, we've learned some things recently about that. That's Bob Cherney, our colleague for many years over at San Francisco State, went through some archives that he had access to, and it appears that Harry Bridges indeed did have affiliation.
Well, that's a good point. Bob Cherney and I, ever since we co-authored a book...
Yeah, we should mention the Soviet archives, right?
Yes. Bob and I co-authored a book back in the middle of the 1980s, and we planned to do a second volume starting in 1933, but we both got sidetracked because we picked into a couple of rich veins of historical data that nobody had mined before. Cherney has been mining the archives opened in 1992, I believe it was, for material on the American communist movement on the West Coast. And I've been investigating the role of the Catholic Church and Catholic labor activists and Catholic priests and Catholic businessmen in the developing contest between labor and business on the West Coast during the New Deal and after. And indeed, Bob Cherney did discover evidence. The character and the reliability of the evidence has been questioned, but the evidence is that Harry Bridges was a secret member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the USA. Now, Bob also stresses, and so does this evidence, that Harry Bridges was independent of Moscow rules to a degree that the American Communist Party found disturbing. And that also needs to be said.
What can we say, Dick Meister, then, about Bridges as a leader here and just how important a role or how central a role he played in what would come to be known as a general strike?
Yeah, well, he was a very charismatic figure, obviously, and often you say, you know, the rank and file does it, and that's true. The rank and file does the things that need to be done, but they do need a leader, and he was stress the great man theory, but he was a great man. I mean, he was just a natural-born leader, just terrific, and because of that, he drew a lot of support, but he also drew a lot of opposition.
And, the opposition being mainly from, well, obviously corporate interests or business interests, as well as the government. I mean, there's a lot of, this is pretty much a red-baiting time.
Oh, absolutely. And you have to understand, too, that the employers who he was up against were really powerful in those days. I mean, the shipping companies, mainly shippers, that was the big industry in San Francisco, and they wanted to stop him at all cost. And I'm surprised he lived. I'm surprised that he wasn't assassinated. It was that serious.
You mean some Pinkerton men with guns or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, and they during the general strike, don't forget, I mean, during Bloody Thursday, the police killed two strikers, shot him in the back.
You know, Harvey Schwartz, those two strikers were described in an article I read as being, well, not really well-known. In fact, kind of ordinary guys, pretty much, weren't they?
Yes, they were ordinary guys. One was a cook and one was a longshore worker. They were rank and file guys. They just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time in terms of a bullet. A policeman, as I recall, stepped out and fired his gun one way and turned around and fired another way. But they were both shot at in the vicinity of Mission and Stewart Street.
The martyrdom became pretty instant after that, didn't it?
Very quick.
Yeah.
Almost immediately. In fact, I would say immediately. The longshore workers put flowers down and marked the spot. Police murder. The police came along and kicked the flowers into the street, and the longshore workers put the flowers back in again.
Talk about the march, because you would think perhaps with all the agitation, with all the anger and indignation over those two murders, as they've been described, that maybe it would have been more violent than it was, wouldn't you?
1934?
Yeah.
Oh, it was plenty violent. The violence had been going along all summer.
No, I'm talking about the march itself, though.
Oh, the march itself. I'm sorry. You're referring to July 9th.
Yeah.
The march up Market Street.
On Market Street, yeah.
It was somber. It was dignified. It impressed the population. It impressed people who were not necessarily sympathetic before that with the dignity of the workers and burying their dead. They marched up Market Street bareheaded. I believe Beethoven's funeral music was played. And it really had a role, many people think, in turning public opinion around and developing public sympathy for the workers who were on strike, for all the marine workers. It was not just longshore workers. There were seagoing workers in the sailors union in the Pacific and other smaller trades, marine trades. And when the arbitration proceedings came down somewhat later, they came down in favor of the longshore workers.
Well, we've got a cut of Sam Cagle actually describing the funeral. Let's hear that.
There wasn't a single sound. I mean, nobody said anything. He just got in line and walked. And it was, I don't want to say that it was thrilling, because it wasn't thrilling in that sense. It was just a matter of respect that you were doing to two guys who unfortunately got shot in the back. And I don't want to say this because I'm not certain of it, but I would guess that in my mind, I was wondering what was going to happen afterwards. Because we had already been talking about a general strike. That was not new talk.
Harvey, you want to comment on that cut that we just heard?
Yeah. Well, I think Sam puts it in a nutshell. He describes the dignity of the situation. And as he saw it, and he was there, and he joined the funeral procession, by the way. During that day, they were having mediation proceedings. He was involved in them, and he was able to cut out early and to join the funeral procession. So he saw it himself. He's not describing something that he heard about later or read.
He was there.
Yeah.
But Bill Issel, you've brought to our attention the fact that people like Sam Cagle, or for that matter Dave Sullivan, who we've had on Forum to talk about the strike a number of years, has been, wrote a book about it, Joel Sullivan's father, for those who know Joel Sullivan from Chronicle, there's a sense that it's been pretty much, well, ideologically leftist, that is the historical record, isn't it?
The writing about American labor history generally has historically been more from the left than from the center or from the right, despite the fact that most of the American labor union movement membership has been just the opposite. Mostly from the center and the right, and not so much from the left. But that's changing, and it's changing for a number of reasons that we really can't go into here, except the fact that people my age, in their late 60s, are now being joined in the writing of labor history by people in their 20s and 30s who don't have the same kind of family or ideological connection with the old days. But let me say several things about your question that pertain directly to the general strike and to the waterfront strike prior to the general strike. First and foremost, I would say, and I detail this in a book that's coming out in December, the waterfront strike in the San Francisco Bay Area and the general strike need to be seen as a local instance of an international competition that was reaching its sort of high point in the middle of the 1930s between the communist movement and the Catholic Church's attempt to revitalize its own religious membership and to meet the perceived threat that the Pope saw coming from the communist movement and to a lesser degree from the fascist movement. The Pope had made a kind of accommodation with the fascist movement in Italy in 1929 and accommodated himself even more in 1931 when he shrank his so-called Catholic Action activities in Italy. But here in the United States, the Catholic bishops did not decrease their anti-communist and pro-labor activities. And here in the Bay Area, you had two archbishops who were the national leaders of the Catholic pro-labor movement. First, Edward Hanna, who played a key role in the settlement of the 34 strike, and his successor, John J. Mitty, who became archbishop in 1935. Now, at the very time that the newly arrived, soon-to-be archbishop came to San Francisco and was building up the pro-labor Catholic movement and the anti-communist Catholic movement, the Communist Party was sending two leading communists to San Francisco to build up the communist movement. The two people were Sam Darcy and Harrison George. And together, they not only recruited new members into the alternative communist movement to the longshore movement, a union called the Marine Workers Industrial Union, but they also published a new newspaper called the Waterfront Worker. And then later in 1938, after the strike, an actual People's World newspaper began to be published also by the communists. So this competition, which was already moving fast, in 1933, with several new organizations set up by the Catholic Church to compete with the communists and to support the labor movement, which, of course, got a huge revitalization from Congress's passage of the Norris-LaGuardia Act in 1933. When the unions decided to strike on the waterfronts up and down the coast, the Catholic activists had already been organizing for a year, creating new organizations, making sure that their members in the police department, in the AFL craft unions, and in the Teamsters Union, and in the waterfront unions were on board. And when the strike moved into May and then June of 1934, so did this competition, which was part of a international competition between the Catholics and the communists.
You're saying the strike has its roots in what we call good old-fashioned American competition, which we usually associate with capitalism more than communism. But that's a very good picture you provided, Bill, and one that certainly I think younger people particularly want to know about. And I think, Meister, as long as we're getting a picture here of what was described by Bill as the local and the international coming together, talk about how this changed, San Francisco became a labor town as a result.
San Francisco became indeed a labor town on a par with, say, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia. And it's this movement in San Francisco spread out all over the country. And it helped in the organization of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, a much more militant group than the American Federation of Labor, which was the chief people in San Francisco. They were ahead of the hierarchy, and it led to it was an inspiration. If nothing else, it just showed that, hey, this, look what you can do.
Solidarity can work.
Yeah, I mean, solidarity is easy to talk about, but try to accomplish it is very difficult. But this showed that it could be done, and if it was done properly, it could be very successful, and it was inspirational, as I say, and it still is. And the important thing is that every year we do things like this. We celebrate it. And this keeps it alive, keeps the idea alive. And if they could do it then, we can do it now.
Well, that's I'm sure labor people are heartened to hear that, and people who are activists and so forth. But you know, this may be a whole other subject for another day, but you think about the kind of zeal and commitment and passion and solidarity at that time as opposed to the difficulty of bringing fractured groups together today, the fact that you pick up a newspaper, if people read the newspaper, average newspaper reader is about 55 years of age, but no labor columns anymore. They're in the business page for the most part. I mean, it's quite a quantum difference.
Oh, yes, very, very different. Once the labor beat, which I covered for the Chronicle, was a major thing, and the labor movement was very important to the media. No longer so.
But this influence on San Francisco becoming a labor town, I mean, there are people who decry the fact that unions have had such an influence on San Francisco politics, and there are people who celebrate it, and, you know, it depends who you're talking to. But nevertheless, a lot of the seminal kind of catalyst and, well, embryonic stuff was here in the general strike, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. That was the beginning of it all. I mean, there were certainly movements before then, going way back to the beginning of that last century. But no, this was the catalyst. This said, this is a labor town, and we're going to do it right. And luckily, as I said before, they had a leader who could mold it, get it going in the right direction.
Let's hear Harry Bridges again. In fact, just want to bring his voice back into this discussion. This is Harry Bridges on what we heard Harvey Schwartz earlier define as the shape up.
There was bootleg joints there, and pool halls and things like that. And bookmaking joint, or even a shooting gallery. See, was right there. And that's where the shape-up was, right there. You just stood there and waited for the gang boss. Your own gang boss would give you orders. Okay, you knock off the job the day before. Okay, ferry in the morning. That meant beat the ferry building in the morning, right across the street, see? And your gang boss would come along and say, okay, Pier 35, 8 o'clock. Or the boss would come around and say, go home, nothing today.
That kind of sums it up, doesn't it, Harvey?
Yes, I think it does quite nicely.
And the wages also, I mean, let's talk about how unfair they were, at least as far as a comparative marketplace for labor and all that at the time.
At the time, the wage was not such an important issue. The hourly wage was not such a difficulty for the waterfront workers. The problem was the intermittent work, and also really that shape-up itself. I mean, that was the real problem, the degraded hiring system that they wanted to get rid of.
No benefits either.
No benefits, yeah. The kind of benefits we think of, health and welfare, all that stuff comes later on. If you could just get a basic contract that allowed you to have representation on the job, you were doing real, real well. In the 1930s, you know, Bill mentioned that the there's some question about the Soviet archives. I think that there is a good question about the Soviet archives as it relates to Bridges' membership or non-membership in the party, which has been such a big thing for many people for many, many years. I don't think you can trust those archives, and it seems to me that I've always sort of taken Bridges' word when he said 95% of what they say about me is true. I've worked with party people, but I'm not a member of the party. I think that whole issue is really not as important as what kind of a leader he was and what kind of a movement he led and what he did for working people. And I think Dick, you know, pretty much summarized that real well. And I think that's what we ought to be looking at.
Well, we'll be looking at that and much more as we continue to look back at this general strike right here in San Francisco when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Michael Krasny. You're listening to a pre-recorded edition of Forum on Labor Day, and we rounded up three veterans of labor history and of writing about labor and who have been educators in the world of labor history. William Issel with us in studio, Dick Meister and Harvey Schwartz, and talking about the strike of 1934, which has certainly been an extremely important marker as far as not only labor history and the history of the labor movement, but as an ongoing cultural and political enduring fact of life, not only for us here in the Bay Area, but as we heard earlier, for many throughout the country and perhaps even one might add, internationally, because it was an international union that went out on strike of longshoremen. And again, Harvey Schwartz is a curator of the ILWU Oral History Collection. He's the author of Solitary Stories, an Oral History of the ILWU. Dick Meister co-authored A History of Farm Labor called A Long Time Coming, freelance writer and columnist, and Bill Issel, William Issel, is professor of history emeritus at SF State, visiting professor of history at Mills College, and coordinates the Bay Area Labor History Workshop. I thought, since before the break we heard Harvey Schwartz say, well, you know, the important thing where Harry Bridges is concerned is the leadership that he represented and the force that he certainly was, which was something to reckon with to this day in terms of his influence on this and the labor movement. I thought we'd hear another clip from Harry Bridges actually talking about what went on at the time.
Another time we were marching, and the attitude of the guy, I couldn't convince him because they knew all the cops. They'd never shoot us. They took all the old cops off the waterfront and sent some new ones down. And suddenly the shots ring up, and one of our guys falls right down and he's spurting blood. My partner, and of course he was a real anti-communist guy, my partner, yeah, said, hey, he's been shot. I said, of course he's been well shot. I've been trying to tell you that. See? Then he wakes up, so he says, let's go. So we break away and we run across the vacant lot and around the corner. I went back and saw it later. And just as we turned the corner, you heard the shots go through the corner of the building, see? Missed us by about 6 inches, see? Just got around the corner. Because then I was looking around over my shoulder, now I could see the cop with the gun.
Well, there's the voice of Harry Bridges coming to us from that perspective of 1934. And Dick Meister, it was very important that he pointed out that that guy was anti-communist, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it was a way of saying, we're not all red. And that was a message that he wanted to get across to the public. I mean, he was very mindful of that, wasn't he?
Yes. And it's in terms of history, it's irrelevant whether he was or was not a communist. But it's also, if he was a communist, so what? The communists were very, very influential in the strike, and they were for all the right things. And the Chronicle, among the other three papers in town, daily papers, were violently against.
There were at one time four papers. That's
two
right.
Hearst papers.
A lot of people listening say, really? You
know, yeah.
A lot of young people.
The Chronicle, for instance, said, oh, he's leading a revolution. There's an insurrection. They described it. You know, it wasn't a strike. It was a revolt. Maybe it was. And Bridges himself said, he says, a strike is a small revolution. That's what it is. And that was pretty accurate. The things that he was charged with and the strikers were charged with seemed to me to be good things. They're trying to shake up the community. They're trying to reorder the economic system. Yes. So nothing bad about that. But just calling somebody a communist was, that's terrible. We know they're terrible. They weren't out to overthrow the government, that's for sure. They had other things in mind.
As Keevan says in my headphones, they're calling Obama a socialist now. But you heard, by the way, we had a bleep, Harry Bridges there, as you can well understand. His language was fairly raw and... Well, he's a waterfront guy, but Bill Issel, is it, you think, to you irrelevant that he was a member or not a member of the Communist Party?
Well, First of all, full disclosure, I've been a union member most of my life, beginning as a member of the Electricians Union here in San Francisco, and for many years a member of the California Faculty Association, and even a delegate to the San Francisco Labor Council from the San Francisco State Union, and I'm a retired member now. As a professional historian, I have to call upon your listeners to make a distinction between truth with a small t, and that is our provisional knowledge about what actually happened in the past, and our assessment of the meaning and significance of what happened in the past. Now, we do need to debate, as in all things, the character of the evidence about Harry Bridges' membership or non-membership in the Communist Party. But that said, we also need to move on, and I agree with Dick and Harvey, to the question behind that question, which is, if Harry was a member, to what extent did the party dictate Harry's decisions about strategy and tactics, and to what extent was party membership the all-important defining character of Harry's own activities as a labor leader? Now, I speak on the basis of having talked with Harry about this in the 1980s and having interviewed a number of people who knew Harry and worked with him in various ways, mostly from a moderate or conservative point of view. And I'm speaking of Jack Henning and David Selvin and several other members of veterans of the 1934 strike. Let me go back to the international dimensions of this San Francisco contest. The international dimensions were such that both the Catholic Church and the Communist Party were conducting an all-out, no-holds-barred competition over influence with and, a power over public policy. And here in San Francisco, the Catholic Church activists included a number of people from the business community who had moved away from their earlier laissez-faire, let's destroy unions altogether, toward a much more cooperative approach, one that we historians call a corporatist approach, one that would call for a cooperation between business and labor and government.
Bill, let me cut to the chase here, if
sure.
I may. I think you're suggesting that maybe from the historical record we need to have greater insight into the role that moderates played
Absolutely.
In bringing about resolution to this.
Absolutely. Story.
I mean, that's kind of the bottom line. Would everybody agree with that? That fair
yes,
enough
yes,
to you?
Yeah.
Everybody accept that? Okay. we got common agreement among do we have common agreement on something else, I'm wondering, Harvey Schwartz, and that is that if it hadn't been for Bloody Thursday, there wouldn't have been the notoriety, there wouldn't have been the impact.
I think that's probably true. As sad as that is, I think the killings on Bloody Thursday and the parade that followed, the funeral parade that followed and so on would have meant that the longshore workers might not have done so well in the long run. They did do well in the arbitration proceedings which followed the strike. And public opinion, I think, played a big part in that.
About that for a moment. What came out of the strike, actually? I know a number of people may want to know, certainly.
What came out of that was that hiring would now be done through a hall, which was supposed to be jointly regulated by the employers and the longshore workers in the case of the longshore industry. However, the dispatcher, the person who dispatched somebody to work, was going to be a union member. So that meant that control was now in the hands of the workers. That meant the end of the shape-up, the end of the corruption, the end of the unseemly kinds of things that had gone on before. Now workers would be dispatched in rotation from the union hall. The person who last had a job would now go to the end of the line. And that's been strictly adhered to ever since.
It's a big victory.
It was a terrific victory. They also got a coastwide contract, which was very important to them, because if you don't have a coastwide contract, one port can work while another's on strike. So there were a certain number of benefits. They got a six-hour day to share the work during the Great Depression.
How long did it take for the other ports or counties to adopt what was won in the general strike?
Well, all the longshore ports got the same thing. It took a little bit longer, sometime longer, for the Sailors Union, the Pacific folks, to get what they wanted. But in terms of the waterfront workers and coastwide, they all got the same thing. They all got control over dispatching.
And other countries?
Well, we're looking now at just the West Coast big strike of 34. Other countries, that's another story.
Villa, you wanted to add something here?
I did. I agree that the use of live ammunition by the police on July 5th led the police to pull back. The police chief, William J. Quinn, was one of the Catholic activists who was part of this, what I call a Catholic cadre, engaged in this competition with the Communist Party. They were pro-labor, anti-communist. The police chief was chastened by the murders, and they were murders. So those two men, one of whom was a Communist Party member, were shot in the back. They were not the victims of, you know, bullet spraying. But one of the most important consequences of the community-wide outrage at the murders and shock was that the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce began a process of dismantling its industrial association, which had worked with the Waterfront Employers Association to take a very, very hard, strict line that they would not bargain with the ILA or with the strike committee. When the Industrial Association was finally disbanded, the Chamber of Commerce and the president of the shipowners at the time of the strike, who later would become mayor, Mr. Lapham,
the father of Lewis Lapham, in fact, of Harper's Magazine. Yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah. Roger D. Lapham was his name. And Lapham and Jack Shelley, another one of these Catholic activists, and a variety of other labor leaders, including, first of all, Harry Bridges and the CIO, came together in a system of labor relations that would last until the 1960s.
In fact, the following year was the National Labor Relations Act, I think, was it not?
What's that?
The following year was the National Labor Relations Act.
Yeah, that's right.
That was 1935.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And which this may have had some relationship to, one could assume.
Well, when the National Labor Relations Act was found constitutional, that was a cold water bath for the San Francisco intransigent laissez-faire business leader faction. And that moved them in the direction of adjusting to what they realized was going to be a new reality. That didn't mean they stopped fighting against it and did not attempt to limit it in the future, which they did. But that's another story.
Well, Dick Meister, I'd like to get your take on just what you were alluding to before. When you think about the lack of coverage now of labor and the dearth of perhaps the same kind of solidarity that one could celebrate if one is so disposed at this period. What is the legacy as you see it? What is the ongoing legacy of this strike?
Well, it's for one thing, it's a model. I mean, it just
this remains a model.
It remains a model, and it all these years, it still remains a model. And I think that's the key thing. Yeah. This is what you should do. This is what you can do, and this is what you'll get if you're successful at it.
It was a model during the 60s, I was thinking, because I mean, all the asperity against the police force, for example, almost seemed to well up in a way that was reminiscent of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But what else, as far as just ongoing significance to people on this Labor Day of this general strike?
Well, beyond, there are a lot of specifics, but I think beyond, the main thing still remains the idea of solidarity. I mean, that's just, it's a simple concept, but it's very hard, as I said, very hard to carry out, but it's... And one thing about the hiring hall that the ILWU got that should be, I think, is just think, if you get your job, you don't go to the employer, you go to the union to get your job. And your loyalty remains with the union. You don't work for an employer, you work for the union, is in effect what it means. And it's been done in other industries, and I guess this is one of the first, but it's a very important concept to have the hiring hall. That the union has the control of the jobs is in effect.
A lot of people have their conception of this whole period and the world we're talking about here. Harvey Schwartz from On the Waterfront, which I think probably disturbs people on the left since Ilya Kazan was an informer during the McCarthy era and he had a lot to do with that movie. But what do you just think about the sense as a historian of what that movie was able to create?
What that movie was able to create?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of its reality or how much based it was on the actual sense of things that we had.
Well, one of the things that I always remember from that movie is that the central figure played by Brando says, "I'm a longshore worker. There's no place for me to go. I have no home now. Where can I go?" He could have gone to the West Coast. And that's blacked out. I mean, essentially, you know, that exit that he might have taken to go to the West Coast to get away from corruption, to join a corrupt-free union, is blacked out in the movie, essentially, by his statement. And it's, there's a whole West Coast he could have gone to seek work. At that time, there was so-called breakbulk cargo, hand-handled cargo that, you know, he could have got a job in the West for what he did.
He could have been a contender in the West, maybe.
Well, he could have been. No, he could have been a longshore worker in the West. You know, that's like being a champion.
Just follow Horace Greeley. Go West, young man. But what do you see as the legacy of this strike?
There's a terrific legacy. For one thing, the union pushed for diversity. Bridges himself and others pushed to have black members included. This is 1934. This is not 1965. There's no Martin Luther King yet. That's one aspect. Progressive union that stood for humane politics in a variety of ways. They stood against the fascists for a long period in the 1930s. The organization was clean. The organization was democratic. Everybody got to vote in it. There was a model for a kind of a union that everybody in the United States should have. In this book that I did called Solidarity Stories, which was from the University of Washington Press, it's real new, I basically argue in the introduction that I wrote that this is a model for everybody. And if we want good, clean, progressive, diverse organizations, corruption-free, you should look at the ILWU. Everybody in the labor movement should look at this organization. And in terms of the union having to fight to survive, they had to fight to survive. Again, there's a big strike in 1936-37. Employers did not let up. They baited the heck out of the union in the 1940s. There was a big strike partly over that in 1948, the year after the Taft-Hartley Act. It was after that that you begin to see a mellowing, and it was called a so-called new look on the waterfront when the employers' organization really was replaced by the Pacific Maritime Association, which is still in place, and that was somewhat more modern, at least until the lockout in year 2002 when the employers again tried to attack and destroy the union. They didn't succeed that time, hadn't succeeded in 1934, 36, or 38, or excuse me, 48.
What do you think? You know the name Fred Glass, I'm sure, who's written about
I know
about
Fred
this.
Quite well, yes.
And he talks about the rise in the socioeconomic status of longshoremen as a result of this strike.
Yes, there was a raise in the status, the raise in wages, hours, conditions, and that's what the union was able to do for them. And it seems to me there, again, that's a model for everybody. I mean, you need a good, clean, strong union to represent you and to better your life. Also, it seems to me, you know, we can point to this organization where some of the guys, not all of them, some of them make okay money. What have they done with their money? What do people do in the society with their money? Well, the longshore union people have tried to push progressive politics, humane politics. They stood against apartheid. They've tried to help other unions, like the one in Australia, the Maritime Union of Australia. They tried to help the Liverpool strike along waterfront workers when they were on strike. They've tried to help the black workers in the port of Charleston in recent years. They've used the power they developed for good. I think that's a model for everybody.
An international model, really, a world model, a global model.
Oh, heck yeah.
Do you think there's any significance, though, getting back to America and the Bloody Thursday happened the day after Independence Day? Or is that just coincidental?
It is coincidental. There was a lot of violence. The employers moved to force open the port by running trucks through the picket lines July 3rd. And then on July 4th, this is one of the ironies of this whole situation, if you want to use that term, irony. Almost everybody stopped for July 4th to have picnics and so forth. There was a little bit of skirmishing on the waterfront, but very little. And then again, the employers the next day tried to force open the port, and they did so by running trucks, which were guarded by police, through the longshore workers' picket lines, and you had a big battle up on Rincon Hill, which is now the place where you have the anchoring for the Bay Bridge. Big battle up and down the hill, and then you ended up with Bloody Thursday down at Mission and Stewart. I think July 4th is really just a coincidence.
Well, we've got another cut that I wanted our listeners to hear, and this is an active rank-and-file warehouse union member. Her name is Billy Roberts Hendricks, describing what she hoped for in a union before she became a member.
The longshoremen owned the city, always did, and it was always our dream to be unionized. Just imagine going into a group that stepped up for your rights. See that you have seniority, see that the boss comes to harass you or sleep with you.
I don't know how well that was able to be audible, but essentially she was saying the longshoremen own the city, and you know, there was a great deal of difference from before union membership, obviously, until union membership was brought into fruition. Boss can't sleep with you anymore, huh, Bill Issel?
Well, that's right. I want to mention, another legacy of the strike, sort of two parts. First, as related to an organization that Harry Bridges had a great deal to do with creating in 1935, the Maritime Federation. And the slogan of the Maritime Federation is one important legacy of the San Francisco waterfront and general strike. An injury to one is an injury to all. Now that is what I could call a kind of cultural legacy, a spirit, a sort of standard according to which I've had enough, I won't take it anymore.
Now you're quoting Paderewski, but
yes,
but it's also solidarity again.
It's also solidarity. And one of the ironies of the 1934 waterfront and general strike in San Francisco, which makes this an international event and not merely a local or national event with a legacy, is that the notion of solidarity, as pushed for by the anti-communist Catholic activists in the labor movement, who had a good deal to do with eventually the new look on the waterfront, and before the new look on the waterfront with the establishment of what I call this corporatist system of labor relations, was the notion that dignity and respect is owed by all to all men and women, regardless of background, regardless of gender or origins or, you know, national origin or ancestry or color or what have you.
An egalitarian ideal. Really.
An egalitarian ideal. For the Catholics, it's rooted in religious sensibility. For the communists, it's rooted in a materialist sensibility coming out of the revolutions of the 1840s in Europe. And San Francisco becomes a place unlike most other places in the country after 1934 because of the strike. And that is a place where young and middle-aged people of all backgrounds go and seek the kinds of opportunities and the kinds of solidarity suggested by that slogan. An injury for one is an injury to all.
Well, I noticed, Bill Issel, in your describing the strike that you added waterfront in there. One hears about it often as a general strike, but general strike indeed ought to include the word waterfront. And I'm prompted to ask Dick Meister what the impact was on, well, the other non-waterfront unions.
Well, again, we come back to the idea of the model. And it had a tremendous impact in developing the local labor movement as well as the labor movement elsewhere. But one thing I think we got to remember, it's the ILWU. We got to remember the W part, the warehouseman. And there was a leader who was, Bridges gets all the attention. He deserves a lot of attention. But Lew Goldblatt, the head of the warehouseman, worked jointly with Bridges. And they put together a union constitution for the ILWU, which is undoubtedly the most democratic union constitution you could find anywhere. Nothing, absolutely nothing of importance is done in that union unless the rank and file votes on it. They don't delegate authority to some leader he'll take care of us, and we'll just, if he does what we think he should do, then we'll reelect him. But they vote on all the major policies at conventions and otherwise. So it still remains a model of democracy, whereas the ILA from the movie, that movie was on the waterfront, was fairly accurate. They were, and I think still are, pretty corrupt and scary. I mean, I was around them several times covering things, and they're a bunch of thugs. I mean, there really was the mafia. It really had control. But
unfortunately,
that's there, not
a lot
not
of
here.
Thugs got into the unions.
Yes.
And have remained, perhaps one could argue, and I would be one of them. But what you talk about the ILW, what about the IW? What about the Wobblies? Did they play a role here, Harvey Schwartz?
Well, the reference to an injured one is injured all actually is taken from the IWW. Yeah. They were very much for diversity and for including everybody in their period of heyday, 1905 to 1917 or so.
Right up to the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, and they existed in the 1920s, but they lost a lot of their power because the government and the police and so forth put all their leadership in jail and, you know, rousted them around during World War I's patriotic binge of that time. Their power was really essentially broken by the World War I situation. But the idea, and actually goes back into the 19th century, as I recall, to the Knights of Labor, too. But the that reference to an injury isn't an ongoing thing. I think we need to define a couple of terms. A general strike means everybody is down, not just the waterfront workers, but all trades, all union people. That was what was going on in the general strike of 3 days from the 16th to the 19th of July in 1934. And it was a sympathy strike and sympathy for the people killed and for the position of the waterfront workers. But it was all unions and all trades. The Teamsters and others were on strike at the same time. Also, we should clarify that the ILWU is a West Coast located, West Coast Canton, Hawaii, whereas the ILA we've been referring to is East Coast only. But they were joined, Bridges suggested joining the ILA, that is to have the West Coast people join the ILA in 1933 and 34, and they did for that period of time, but they left in 1937, partly over the corruption and other issues.
And the ILWU later became part of the CIO.
Yes, it did in 1937.
Okay, well, it's great to get that clarification at the end here as we come to the conclusion of important, and I thank all of you for this important hour, which really served, I think, to give a real picture of this particularly important historical event and its ongoing legacy. I want to thank Harvey Schwartz, curator of the ILWU Oral History Collection, author of Solitary Stories, an oral history of the ILWU. Dick Meister, freelance writer and columnist, co-author of A History of Farm Labor called A Long Time Coming, and William Issel, who is professor of history emeritus at San Francisco State and visiting professor of history at Mills and coordinator of the Bay Area Labor History Workshop. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I hope you have a happy Labor Day. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.